Hello all, and welcome to Masterclass this evening, August 27th, 2023. Appreciate you guys showing up for some great Masterclass presentations this evening. Should have a lot of fun. It's always something new, which I love, and there's always something going on. And the word is getting out there. Instructors are loving it. I don't know how they're finding it, but I am putting it on to PGI Pods. So I think they're watching them, which is really cool.
We have our own podcast. Who's doing it? That's awesome.
Well, I built it and I keep putting things up on it, but yeah, we can do our own podcasts in the internship if we want to. I will put it up there. So right now I'm putting Masterclass up there, and I have all of Doc's on there, and I have some from Tina. I have some from other companies, you know, so it's pretty cool. You should go to pgipods.com. Okay, so we have transcript. This evening, we have Isaac Ritz, we have Tamara Richardson, and Srikanth Kubala. Hope I said that right. I think I did. Isaac, are you ready to present?
I am. It might be a little short, though. I really hope not, but I was really trying not to rabbit hole. Is it fine if it's like a little under 15 minutes?
Yeah, because we'll have a question and answer also, you know, so if anybody has any questions about what you're talking about.
Okay, and I did include some questions that even I thought of, like, okay, someone's gonna want the answer to these. So hopefully that goes well. But right, yeah, exactly. I have my own slides here.
Good.
So I'll go ahead and share these. Okay. I'm just making sure I'm trying to get it to where I can pull it up on the side.
No problem.
There we go. Okay. So I was going to do a presentation on malware analysis. So this is sort of a specialization on something that's many would consider already specialized, right? So in cybersecurity, we really can understand that as a specialization on computer science, right? Information technology, and really focusing on the security aspects of technology as a whole. But there are so many different paths that can take. And one of those that you might find yourself coming across, especially as you get more into the advanced line of work, I would consider it a little more niche, but not really. It's sort of the evolution of where you would get with your skill as you follow along sort of a blue team path. And I'll get where I'm going with that very shortly here. But I'm going to go over things like the actual salary and career expectations you can see up front, like in job descriptions and such. We'll be leading into basically what you'd expect day to day if you were to go into malware analytics, which really you won't see much of a difference from, as you can see up there, advanced blue teaming. You won't see much of a difference from someone like an SOC analyst. Really a lot of blue teaming jobs. So, salary, career opportunities, what are we looking at? Well, We can expect sort of around a 33%-ish increase in the next few years. I would say in the next couple decades, for the cybersecurity market, which is really incredible when comparing to things like our average job increase, job opportunities in the U.S. is pretty low. I believe it's around 6 to 8%. Don't quote me on that, but we already know cybersecurity is a huge field, and it's growing even more as technology is expanding. I would consider it exponential as long as we, you know, keep advancing. And malware analysis is right up there with it. So we can see that on par with everything else in our area. We can see that matching up to what we would see with a regular penetration tester job. We could see that in our SOCs. We can see that with our management teams in IT and everyone who does compliance and risk analysis. What we're looking at here is I have a more region-centric salary right here in the top left. So that's how much a malware analyst makes in Louisville, Kentucky. And then I have something more US-wide. So if you look at it a little carefully, yeah, there's big numbers there that seem to be a wide range. If you look at it a little carefully, the range is even wider. I got these numbers from Glassdoor, so that's a very popular site for trying to figure out salary estimates when you're actually looking for these jobs and how much you might expect when you go into them. So in total in the US, you might expect sort of an average of around 87,000 a year. I believe this is an average, not a median amount. So more of a middle amount you might end up seeing a little higher. But it's a huge range, and it really depends on the company you work at. Are you working at a Fortune 500? Are you working for a local business? And this can really translate across the board for a lot of our technology jobs, is you'll see a huge pay gap from company to company. And while experience does play into that, I believe it does matter who you work for in the end. Now, as I said, experience does matter to an extent. So while we're looking at a big pay range here, it's really going to matter what kind of experience you're going into it with. So this is an advanced position. If you were to go into malware analytics, you can't go into this with nothing, basically. So where we're at right now, coming up, it's most people here are coming towards the end of their degrees, whether that's in a bachelor degree or a master's degree, right? You are setting yourself up as a whole to be in a very good spot, but in our day and age, a bachelor's degree is really entry level, right? So we're looking at a 4 years experience, but it most of the time won't be enough with just the degree. So with malware analytics, you'll probably want to go into certifications and more specialty, but also look into starting somewhere else and then getting to this position within that company, if that makes sense. So if you're working for a company, it's better to work your way up than to find it on a job search website. So we're in a good position right now, bachelor's degree. What kind of degrees could we really get to reach this point of malware analytics? And by the way, I will be getting into what exactly this kind of job is and more on that area. I thought this would just be easier to start with because everyone's going to understand the numbers. But a bachelor's degree in cybersecurity is great. That's security centric. It's technology focused, but with a specialty in security, you know. But it might help to branch out a little more and have a more all-encompassing degree. So computer science works perfectly for something with malware analytics. I would suggest even more so in computer engineering. And from speaking with advisors at schools, those types of degrees, it can also help to have something like a degree in math. But that's where the certifications come in. So it's great to have the base level bachelor's degree going into whatever you want to go into, but those certifications are really going to come in handy. So I'll be talking about that later. We do have a slide for that, and I do have sort of a path that we can look down. Sorry, one second, my cat's meowing. I'm going to let her out of the room. Okay, excuse me for that. So, what is a malware analysis? What is a malware analyst going to be doing in their day-to-day? Well, I'm being very specific with that title, but you might end up being under other titles and actually researching malware. So in reality, a malware analyst it's really just a glorified SOC analyst, someone who's working in blue team type of defense operations, so security operations centers. Those analysts, they're working on incident response, they're working on reports and logging, and by malware analysis, all that's saying is that SOC analyst would take on the responsibility of looking at what occurred after the fact if there was a breach. So if malware were to find its way onto a workstation, it's up to that malware analyst to look into that and figure out, okay, how did this get here? What is it trying to do? Can we do anything with this? And you know, how is it working? How is it even doing what it's trying to do? That's the whole point. So when we're looking at it like that, you can see that can be a wide range of people that might end up fulfilling this role. So while I did say it's a very advanced role, you might not end up seeing this role as specifically a malware analyst. You might see it labeled as something else, but they'll take on these responsibilities. So it's blue team oriented, right? Everything is going to be occurring where it's coming to you, basically. Now, there are some things online, a really popular GitHub repo, a repository, collects malware, basically, and uses that as sort of a research base where they collect obfuscated programs. Excuse me. They collect obfuscated programs. They'll deobfuscate it sometimes. And it really depends on who's providing it. And they use it as sort of a glossary of, okay, here's all this information. Do what you will with it. In the background, I'm going to be trying to find that as we go along, because I cannot remember the name for the life of me, but I'll find that for you all and we'll go back to it because it is very interesting. But like I said, it's blue team oriented. So it's not really you going out and finding the malware. It's doing your research, seeing vulnerabilities and what kind of exploits are out there, and then seeing how those vulnerabilities are used. So if malware is involved, not really malware per se. Actually, it's more like if there's scripting involved, if there's code involved, how does that code assist in creating that exploited vulnerability? So we can see that in anything lower level. So it might end up being a privilege escalation on an operating system. So something that actually affects the machine itself, not really your web applications or anything like that. It's very likely that we'll be looking at a lot of scripting as from a malware analyst standpoint. I cannot find this. Okay. Well, like I said, we'll get back to that. I'm sorry. Anyway, with malware analysis, there's dynamic and there's static. And what do we really mean when I'm saying that? So it'd be easier to start with static analysis. So we can sort of infer just on those words alone what I'm talking about. But by static, I'm really saying, okay, you're going to take and look at these files very passively. You're not going to do anything with them, but you're going to observe them and see those functions without actually making them do anything. So, like I said, they're passive research on files, programs, and what their properties are. So a huge part of that could be looking at file extensions, maybe opening the code itself. Really, there are a lot of programs out there that can help you actually look into it more. So that's where reverse engineering can come in. So if you've had any experience with this, you might be familiar with tools like Ghidra, or I believe Cutter and IDA. These are, what would be the word? Disassemblers. They can take programs, open them up for you, and let you sort of run through the assembly code. So by assembly code, I'm talking about that sort of middleman language between something like the C programming language and binary. It's sort of along the path to the point where it's still human readable, just barely, and it's just at the point of turning into machine code along that path. We'll get more into that in a second, but passive research, that's really the summary of static malware analysis, but you can go even further into this. So we can also look at it from a dynamic perspective, and the whole point of that is seeing, okay, what is it going to do when it's actually running? There are types of programs that may change as they're running. Now, you might be able to go into code. If you're lucky, it might not be obfuscated, and you could actually read it, right? If you're lucky, you might be able to see that, okay, it's going to change when this happens, or if it logs this event, or if it notices Internet Explorer opening, it's going to cause this kind of change, or it's going to start this script, or create a file or something. But it's much easier to see that in a controlled environment. Okay, when it starts running, I noticed this change happened, and I was able to monitor that with this software that I have running in the background. It's much easier to see from a dynamic perspective something like polymorphic or metamorphic code. So if with very sophisticated malware, it might end up recreating itself in a way that will change its signature hash, but it won't change the functions of the malware itself. If that happens, static malware analysis can be a much more tedious job because things are changing and you're trying to reread something that you might have read already. And it's something completely different, but it's doing the exact same thing. Dynamic analysis, you're going to be looking at it and you're going to be looking at the process flow and figuring out, okay, this is exactly what it's done. And this is how it got there. This is what changed along the way. Now, right under this, you'll see that I have listed a few different paths you can take. So this is daily operations, but like I said, it's much more likely that you're going to see someone under a different position or labeled differently is going to be taking on these responsibilities as they go along. It just depends on how advanced and they are and how much skill they have. Please don't tell me I was muted the whole time.
You were not.
We heard you.
Ooh. I just had a heart attack. My microphone has like a little clip thing and it looked like it was muted. Whew. Okay. Thank you. Anyway, lost track for a second. You'll be looking at different labels, right? So someone who might actually partake in malware analysis and actually these sort of more difficult jobs in reverse engineering or even incident handling that, you know, you might see just an SOC analyst do, it might be from a forensics background. So someone who is supposed to come in, investigate, and figure out what happened after a breach. they might not be part of the team normally, but it could also be someone like from a government perspective. This is really, I would see computer forensics as sort of, you might see this on your CSI shows if that makes sense for you. They're your people who come in and try to figure out the problem and how it got to that point. They're following the event. They're following not only the path that a program might have taken, so the malware analysis part, but really what an intruder might have done along the way and how someone might have interacted with the network, who that person is, and really the steps to get there. So I would say that that's probably the most closely relevant to what I'm talking about right now. But there are also your incident response teams, so someone who might be either on base or hired on from a management service provider, a security operations center. Your incident response teams, they're the first in line, right? They're your front line, that they're going to be there the second that anything suspicious happens. One of these people are going to be the ones that actually notice some kind of change. They're probably the ones that see, okay, this guy quarantined by our antivirus. Let's hand this over to forensics or our actual malware analysts, as they are titled. You might end up working in a security operations center under these things, or really you might end up in an antivirus company. So somewhere like Malwarebytes or McAfee. And in this position, it's going to be a lot more revert to engineering and a lot more research oriented, because not only are you going to be looking at incident response and things like that internally, but it's very much more likely that you're going to be looking into research for the antivirus itself and trying to improve it. So in order to do so, you need to see signatures. You need to see how malware works. You might not have a signature-based antivirus. You might have something like BlackBerry Cylance, which is actually based on its machine learning. So it's based on the behavior of certain programs and trying to find, okay, what's suspicious behavior? How is malware going to act on a machine? And how is that different in comparison to what would be normal operations on that computer? So really, this is going to be, I would say, your most crucial area for a malware analyst to end up at. Now, reverse engineering. What do I mean by this? What do I mean by assembly language? And really, how far can you go down that rabbit hole? Because like I said, I tried to keep it short just because this can be an entire topic on its own. Now, if you haven't heard about it, assembly language is sort of, like I said, it's the in-between. So everyone here has heard of programming, I would hope. But if not, it's really how we interact with our computer, right? So assembly language is just sort of a lower version of that. It's, if you think of the word, if you've ever heard of opcodes, if you ever looked at something like this in purple and were wondering, okay, what does this even mean? That's probably assembly language that you were looking at. This up here is just another version of it. There's different types of it. So we would be looking at something like x86 assembly language, ARM assembly language, and we can kind of compare this to C at the closest. I would say C is much more readable, but it's probably our closest to assembly that someone might be willing to learn without, you know, getting a headache immediately. That's saying something, but yeah, so we can see a process here of someone actually working with a computer, right? So we might see even Java would be a good example here. They're using C in this, so it's hashtag include studio H. This is C language. It's very simple. It's compiled. And it's taken out into, this is not assembly, but that's byte, that's a binary right there, of course. I just took the closest I can get to an actual graph. It might have been better for me to make it, but it takes whatever language you have it rewrites it, and it goes into assembly, and then that's the final step, or it goes through some other steps, but in a major aspect, that's what it gets to before it's turned into machine code and something readable for an actual processor. When you have something like an executable file, something that you might double click on your screen and actually opens up a program for you, even a video game, it could be really any random tool that you might have that ends in .exe if you're using Windows. If it double clicks and you can open it, you might be able to use something like Ghidra to disassemble that program. And what happens is it doesn't let you read source code necessarily, but it lets you read a disassembled version of the program that results in the assembly language. And the closest you can get to a human-readable format without actually decompiling it and getting back to the source code. That can be difficult sometimes, especially if you have encrypted source code or like I said, it can be a little bit of a rabbit hole going down that path, but it can be very important for a malware analyst to at least have a basic familiarity with assembly language in order to actually understand what they're looking at if they were to use a disassembler like Ghidra. Now, I did mention some security certifications earlier, because these can be very helpful for you in actually getting a foothold into what you want to do, both before you get to that position and as you're there, and how to improve your salary and also make your way up the ladder. Now, you might see a wide range here, but I tried to categorize as much as possible. If you look on the left, these are more blue team based to an extent. I took all of these from Paul Jeremy's Roadmap, which is an incredible website. It'll show you just how absurd how many certifications are available. So I hope this can kind of narrow it down. If you are looking into this and you are interested, you might see more of blue team on the left side. This, I would consider this probably easier coming from my perspective of cybersecurity. But if you're coming from more of a software development side, this right side over here might be a little easier for you instead. So we have the CompTIA Cybersecurity Analyst Plus. It's also shortened to CYSA, I believe. Then you have Security Blue Team Level 1. If you're ever getting into the blue team, you'll notice a lot of BTL-1-4. Those are very popular certifications for blue team. I didn't really have much to go off of beyond that, where it was sort of a middle area. It really does, like I said, it is a very advanced subject. It kind of jumps to that point after you already have a base and you already know where you're doing. But I would consider, like I said, forensics, incident response to be sort of that stepping point. If you got to that, you're already in an amazing position to move on to malware analysis, if you aren't at that point already. So GIAC has a lot of really good, GIAC has really a lot of good certifications in this field. So we have incident handler, forensics, and reverse engineering. And then on this side, it's more of an exploit developer. So really you're looking at reverse engineering analyst from InfoSec and eLearn Security, exploit developer, GIAC's Python coder. And like I said, it might be a little short. I don't know how much time I took. I apologize. but I wanted to take time for questions. And if no one did have any questions, I included a few here just for inspiration. If you wanted me to go over these, let me know.
So Yvette was asking if you could share that link you were just talking about.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's in the works site, but I'm gonna actually post that in the chat here. And I'm seeing that there are a few other questions, so I'm gonna get to those in just a second.
Okay.
And yeah, you're welcome, absolutely. And Sydney said, why should we in company focus on getting certs? If you think about it, our parents and many teachers didn't have any certs and new computers as it changed. Why should we focus on certs if we know what we are doing? That's honestly, I was flabbergasted as well as to how many are available and really how much we have to focus on them at this point in time, because 6 years ago, certifications weren't even close to necessary. You'd be fine with just your degree. You might be looking at like 2015, go on like a forum and ask, what kind of certifications should I get for this? And everyone's going to say, nothing, go work for the company and they'll teach you. We've sort of flooded our market. There are a lot of people here with incredible skill, right? Everyone knows what they're doing and it, to an extent, at least. If they're here, it's because they were already in technology at some point. They have an extent of knowledge, and then there's the people who have already been working at companies, not to mention those who are just coming into it like you and I. Yeah, security-based. But Sydney, certifications, I think it's really just a more recent thing. And I don't know. I really apologize. That's the best I got for that. Because I did struggle with that as well, trying to figure out exactly why. I think it really was just a company decision across the board. Everyone just wants to make sure they get the best of the best with so many people coming into our field.
Well, you also have to consider that technology is advancing very rapidly. And the time you take to get a degree, within a few years, that gets outdated. And certifications are a way to prove that you're still up to date.
Oh, so very quickly. You're right. And especially with something, like I said, this can be considered much more advanced. It might take a lot more experience under your belt. So if you don't have the certifications, you might have like anywhere from 6 to 15 years in technology and security already. And that honestly might be that would probably be plenty to get into this area. Do I attend any conferences? I have not. But honestly, I would love to if I ever, you know, left my house, left my computer. Yeah, it is security based. But if you like reverse engineering at all and assembly language, that's probably your foot in the door from the software side. And then, you know, certifications along the way, like Lana and I said, certifications help show, okay, I understand this part, but here's what I'm best at, right?
So, additional question for you, if we still have time.
Oh, yeah.
So malware analysis and with the rise of ChatGPT and code generators, do you think there's going to be a sudden marked increase in different types of malware, or do you think we're going to see a effectively steady state where you already had so many distributors that the act of having an easier generator really won't make too much of a difference in the market?
I honestly don't see it making too much of a difference, just because in something like this, it especially to make something sophisticated, you already have to know what you're doing. ChatGPT can be a very good inspirational tool, but to use it on its own without actually knowing what it's doing, it can really be detrimental, and it's honestly not going to work the way you want it to. That can be across the board with just about anything, but especially with malware. If you wanted to make malware, first, it's not going to cooperate with you just because it's going to say it's unethical. But pushing it to do it, it'll do it, just in a really poor way. So honestly, it's not going to do too much. Now, making actual different types of malware, that's a different story. Like I said, it's going to be very good at giving people ideas. My imagination isn't that great, But I feel like someone working with ChatGPT to actually give themselves better inspiration, we're probably going to see a few more types of malware go along, especially as we keep going and evolving technology-wise. Yeah, passive necessity. This is like our baseline now, even though it used to be, okay, this is our mid-tier, this is our intermediate area. No, now it's entry-level. But yeah, any more questions right now? I'm sorry, Ms. Marjorie, I don't know how much time I used. I can go over these that I have on the board still, or?
No, you did good. I think you made your 15.
Awesome. Perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah, you did great.
And then some.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, then some.
Thank you.
All right.
Although I wish you had talked about pushes and poppas.
Oh, like I said, it's a rabbit hole to even get any further than how I got.
You know, I had a question. I'm familiar with if I can remember the name of it. The language that you were talking about.
The C programming language?
No, the other one. The
like assembly or
assembly.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with assembly, but really when it comes down to it, what do we use assembly language for?
You're probably not going to see many people just writing assembly language nowadays. That's why it's so reverse engineering oriented. In the programming world, we love abstraction. We want to make things easier to think about, to do, and programming languages are a huge part of that. So we have higher level, we have lower level, we have machine readable. Assembly language is along the lines of that, and we can take years and write out hello world in binary, but why do that when we can write it in assembly language, which that was many, many years ago, that was the way to do things, right? We could write it out in assembly language, but we've made things easier along the line since then, and we've come up with actual abstraction in the form of real programming languages that are both lower level and upper level. So like your day-to-day Python that you would recognize, Java, JavaScript. But yeah, what you're going to end up seeing in now is trying to break something down that already exists. So like I said, when you use a disassembler, those tools are going to end up breaking your program down into assembly, because that's sort of the closest it can get to rewriting itself without putting it into a programming language. I honestly don't know enough to know why it's not going to just put it into a language for you. I believe it's because of the compilation process. But really, it, instead of just showing you all the binary, it's going to show it to you in assembly language.
Yeah, but one of the biggest issues about this is going to be very processor specific.
Yeah, and that's where the x86 and ARM processors come in. I think a lot of them try to stay competitive by like using the same assembly language, but
it's hard to use the same instruction code, but it's specific to the processor, because you're really all it's doing is queuing up the zeros and ones to be fed to the processor.
Yeah,
or the core now.
But I hope that helps at least a little bit.
It does, because I was always thinking about that. And because I teach the fundamentals of IT, and something that we cover is assembly language, as well as, you know, C# and C and Java and the rest of those. And I tell them this is what, you know, assembly language looks like. But I'm never really sure what to tell them it's used for. So we kind of skip over it, you know.
But we used to use it for hardware, developing the software to run the hardware.
Gotcha. See, that makes sense.
Absolutely. That's really like the computer engineering area and a lot of lower level. I think where we're at right now, it's more like C and just lower level programming languages that that way we don't have to write out in assembly just because it is so extensive to use.
That makes perfect sense now. Thank you.
Good stuff.
Great job. Absolutely great job.
Thank you.
Okay. Tamara. I'm sorry. I never know how to say the name.
It's Tamara.
Okay.
Is it echoing?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, hold on, let me see. Okay,
Yeah, much better.
Better. Okay. So.
Can you share it or do you need me to pull it up?
I'll let you do it because I'm taking too long.
Okay, let me see here. Trying to find the best way I can do it. Now I'll share my screen.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. All right. Greetings, everyone. Greetings, everyone. My name is Tamara Richardson. Tonight, my presentation is going to be over what is a CBDC? Next slide, please. Okay. We will cover in this presentation what a CBDC is, its history, the benefits, and the cybersecurity risks, such as how central banks are protecting CBDC accounts, also how to protect your personal CBDC accounts. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. What is a CBDC? CBD stands for Central Bank Digital Currency, or also known as smart money. It is a distributor ledger technology, meaning it keeps track of all the influx and outgoing transactions. So incoming and outgoing transactions, it keeps a record of it. Just like any other regular bank. So when you go to the fuel station and you scan your card, it's still going to keep a track, just like your regular debit card from your bank account is keeping transactions now. So it'll be the same thing. It is a utilized as a digital government issued currency. So this is where the transactions will be the same. However, the government will know what all of us are doing. So they'll know all your transactions. They'll know everything. It is not a tangible commodity, meaning we can't touch it. It's like your credit card transactions now, like how they have already have been. Or like, once again, how your debit card transactions have been utilized. The value is linked to the issuing country's official currency and backed by a central bank. So people think, oh, money is going out. You know, what are we going to do? Well, this will be a similar alternative. This will be the alternative. It's nothing, you know, it's just we won't be able to touch money. It won't get wet in the rain, you know, in our pockets. We fall in a puddle. It won't get wet, you know, but our phones, you know, we fall in the next slide, please. Our phones, if it falls in the puddle, will get wet. So the history of CBDC. Well, in all honesty, it has been around for 3 decades. In 1993, the Bank of Finland launched the Avant Smart Card. Now, eventually, this card, after about being on the market for like 2 years, it fizzled out. It didn't work well for them. However, as technology advances, technological advances have posed a decline in cash transactions. So we saw a huge surge of this during the peak of COVID-19. So 2 years ago, like 2022, when you would go into a facility and they would say, oh, no, we're not accepting cash. And, you know, you're loaded with that paper, but you can't buy anything. Now you got to do two or different things, come up with, you know, somebody else to get what you need that will accept that your cash, or be prepared to make a credit card payment. So we've already experienced that. You know, we've been experiencing it now. There's still places that will not accept cards as a result of COVID. Central bank roundtables all over the world are now exploring their potential benefits. This is very true. Next slide. Everyone is, this is like the topic of discussion right now, which is why I chose it, because before I did this research, I heard about it, but, you know, it really gave me a lot more knowledge about what's really going on. So, yeah, all these countries, thank you, are talking about this. For instance, it's not really all that new. Like I said, 1993, Finland had a smart card. You know, it fizzled out, but they did have it. So that was, technically, they would be known as the first. The next would be in 2019. 2020, I'm sorry. The Bahamas debuted their sand dollar, and that is a form of CBDC currency, central banking digital currency. So they started using it during the beginning of the pandemic. They were, you know, during that year they were using it. So during that peak, when we couldn't use cash in so many different places because of the hygiene concerns and the transference of COVID, Bahamas went on and kicked in and said, well, now's a good time to use that CBDC thing. 2021, a year later, Nigeria unveiled their e-Naira, which is also a central banking digital currency. Just last year, in September, China presented to the market their digital yuan, and three countries fully launched their CBDC version. They're going to be doing that this year. And in July 2022, there was nearly 100 CBDCs in research or development. So everybody's on it. Next slide, please. This is a visual of what we just what I just discussed with you all. These are the stats. So this shows how over a period of time over the last 3 years, how they have truly increased in usage as becoming a source of currency. And this is the map to the left, those that have implemented, those that are doing research. Next slide, please. Now, let's fast forward to 2023. March 1, 2023, 65 countries are in the advanced stages of CBDC development. And I was just saying in the previous slides that it was 100. 100 a year or so ago, and now it's already 65. Over 20 central banks have launched their pilots, including Brazil, Japan, and Russia. 3 months into 2023, 18 countries have decided to implement their CBDCs this year. Next slide, please. There are two types of CBDCs, wholesale CBDC, primarily utilized by financial institutions such as banks, retail CBDC utilized, and retail CBDC utilized by individuals essentially as digital cash. So that same example, as I said, the same example that I mentioned previously about how are we going to do our transactions if we don't have cash, then that's already, it's like it's already been decided you're not going to have cash. So we're going to be using in our retail transactions when it comes into play, we will be using a CBDC card or our telephones. Next slide, please. Some countries have chosen to already do both, like Brazil, Japan, and Russia. Those three that I mentioned previously, they have already chosen to utilize it in wholesale and retail. Benefits of the CBC. Well, with our current payment systems working in single jurisdictions with a single currency, it is believed that utilizing blockchain technology will make cross-border transactions quicker, smoother, and more reliable. So when you go overseas and you want to transfer money, you're going to have to transfer no money. It's all going to be done on a digital thing. So you won't have to transport. You won't have to worry about, I'm cybersecurity and I'm going on a trip and I packed up about 30 grand. You won't have to worry about that because it'll already be on your card. You know, nobody's going to stop you at customs and be like, why are you traveling with so much money, so much dough? You're good. You know, so that's one worry we won't have to worry about either. They are inherently not volatile, unlike crypto assets. So there is a lot of people in the crypto world that have just been, you know, disappearing lately, if you have followed this at all. So like, we won't have to deal with that because that aspect, because it's already going to be on a card. Everybody's going to be using, you know, some sort of blockchain technology. So, you know, there won't be such a spotlight on them or that are now using it and their safety. So that's one concern as well. Can improve resilience for domestic payment systems. Well, I already kind of discussed that in the first asterisk or bullet, where I was saying cross-border transactions will be quicker, smoother, and more reliable. Well, we won't have to worry about that money conversion being done where we have to walk into the bank, wait into a line. All of that will like cease because we're working on a digital format where we don't have tangible cash. It will foster more competition, which may lead to better access to money, increase efficiency in payments, and in turn, lower transaction costs. It will also improve transparency in money flow. So that goes back to what I was saying in on the first slide or the second slide, that, you know, when we make our transactions, like, it'll be seen, you know, it's already being seen, in all honesty, but like, it'll be seen and the government will see every transaction that we do. Also improve flows and could help reduce currency substitution when a country uses a foreign country in addition to or instead of its own. So here's hoping when we do those transactions like we do now with tangible funds that, you know, maybe that interest rate, that's such a variation in interest rate from country to country, that might go away. Now, if they do that, that would be a seriously big benefit. I haven't heard anything about it just yet, but I am positively looking forward to that. Because that's something that's like a headache, you know, if when you go to that ATM and you're like, dang, I thought I was getting more pounds and this is all I'm getting, because it doesn't transfer the same. And right now, the U.S. dollar is reducing in value, so you're definitely not going to get the same amount in value of another country's currency because ours is dropping so vastly. Cryptocurrencies are almost always decentralized, meaning they can't be regulated by a single authority such as a bank. And that's one of the biggest differences. Next slide, please. Between CBDCs and cryptocurrency is the ability for it to be tracked. So what's the hype? It's only a matter of time, you guys, before this emergent financial instrument becomes mainstream in the United States. As I said, this year, 18 countries are out of that 100 are already looking to implement. They already agreed and are on board. There are another 65 that are researching. So you 65, 18, that's 75 plus another three, that's like 78. You know, so or 88, we're almost there. So that's why I did this presentation, to hopefully educate those of us that didn't know anything about this at all. Like, I knew a little bit, but it was really just hype that I was hearing. Next, therefore, us in cybersecurity industry must continue to focus on the threats. In 2023, the beginning of COVID, our global cryptocurrency theft, hacks and fraud totaled $1.9 billion. That was just in 2022. I didn't give any footage because that alone is mind-boggling. That's a lot of money, that innocent money taken away. Privacy and security are the two most important features when it comes to digital currency. That's why, because $1.9 billion was hacked and taken. Next slide, please. Mitigation of banks. One way to mitigate such threats is to physically separate the money creation and destruction process from those related to modification and validation. The use of cryptographic algorithms and AI to monitor any anomalies that do occur will further strengthen security. CBDCs will reside in protected environments with strict authentication procedures, and point of sales terminals will need to be updated with the latest software to accommodate the CBDC's transactions. Next slide, please. Precaution for consumers. That would be us. So we need to make sure that our apps are secured against tampering, or our clients or our family members or our friends, make sure that they're secured against tampering and manipulation. Employ state-of-the-art security, app, and API protectors capable with capabilities to vulnerable devices. Also, know that the end user behavior will not pose a systematic security risk to CBDCs. Next slide, please. In summary, CBDC could prove to be safer, as it may reduce cash robberies, like I said before, longer lines in the banks, and like I'm also really hoping for is the currency conversion, when foreign currency conversions, maybe that will go away. It may also potentially replace the need to carry physical currency and reduce economic rents associated with transacting in the legacy financial system. An excellent way to keep up with countries who convert to CBDCs, like those statistics that I was speaking of, the 100 countries, the 65, the 18 that are presently have agreed to implement. The way you can keep up with those stats is to follow the Geoeconomic Center. They will continue to track CBDC exploration in the world, around the world. So this is the link to keep up with their progression. Next slide. And that's the research that I did on central bank digital currency. I open the floor to any questions.
So, okay, that was excellent. And it's something that even my girlfriend and I were talking about this the other day, and she was saying, you know, I'm really worried about when cash is gone and it becomes all digital currency. And I was like, nah. So you just proved me wrong, which scares the heck out of me and worries me. I had actually just recently seen, I think it was an Instagram or something like that, of a lady from India. And she was explaining how in 1998, the government had decided all of a sudden at 8 o'clock at night, they said, no more cash is to be used. No more bills. No more, you know, tangible cash is to be used. And they went over to digital currency. And literally that night, 75% of that country was poor. That was it. Went into an economic drop. And that's the problem with the digital currency, because you have to have the currency to have the digital currency. It's not like it's going to be socialized where everybody's going to get the same amount. It really is going to make a difference between low income, middle income, and upper income, where they're going to be a lot left behind with that. And that really is what scares me so much. One question is, do you see our government leaning more towards CBDC? And if not, how long do you think it will take for our company to learn more towards a digital currency?
In all honesty, it's already scheduled, but I would just say for the U.S. to go and switch. It's already scheduled. So I will say 2 years. We're in 2023 now. Expect this in the next 2 years. So that could be at the end of this year. That could be over the summer. But you have to understand, we have already been groomed and went through this. We went through it in the pandemic. So although we may have a shock, it's going to be a shock. But learning the knowledge now and learning how to protect your equipment, your family's equipment, your friends' equipment, your clients, you know, we can, it's not a bad thing, but we can prepare, because if $1.9 billion were taken already in just 1 year from hacks, fraud, then you got to know, if you switch all of our money over, what we're in store for is a hack that happens every 39 seconds. So I think it's about two years before, no, just it's 2 years before the U.S. goes in. We got 2 years or less.
So should we take our money out of the bank?
I don't. Now, I looked for that. I prepared for these questions. Let's just think, because I didn't really find any specific answers, but I just wanted to pose thoughts. Okay. So if you have a bank account and the digital currency, and you have 10 grand in it, right? And they switch over, U.S. goes ahead and says, yeah, let's go ahead and switch over to CBDC, you know. And you have that 10 grand and the CBDC is built on the currency of the money, right? The 10 grand that's in that account, that's what it's based on. You know what I mean? So, because you can take it out and you can put it in. So I would make sure I have a screenshot, and I would make sure I have a printout, a bank printout of how much money I have in that account. I would just go ahead and start doing that now. Like, if you don't keep up with those records, you shred them. No, I don't need them. Now's the time to keep it. So, or to make sure you have a digital copy or something of it. Because if that's going to be an open window when they change it over for everybody. You know it's going to be. It's too many people. It's going to be an open window. So that's an open window for hackers. Clear as day. When that happens,
yeah,
that's why they can't tell us exactly when it's going to happen, because it's an open window. It's too many accounts. So having tangible cash, and cash is no more. Well, it depends on how they choose to phase it out. If they do a hard close where cash is no more, then if you come in there with cash talking about, I want to turn it into CBDCs, they might just look at us like we're crazy because cash is no more. You understand? Now, if they slowly phase it out, then we have time to get that in for an equivalent transfer or whatever is worth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, just trade it out. Hopefully they do a trade out. And hopefully it'll be dollar for dollar, because we still don't know how much that would be.
Right, and they haven't mentioned that yet. Those are key things that they haven't mentioned. I'm searching, I'm hunting, I'm still looking.
Yeah, but and I think that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna look and see what these other countries are doing and how they made the change. You know, Bahamas having the sand dollars, I'm sure that they made a change. You know, how did has it done better for them? Has it made it worse for them? Obviously, India, and I believe it was 98 that it happened, you know, that didn't go well for them. There was already so many lower income in India as it was, and it made it that much more. You know, what was wrong with that? What did they do wrong? So it's something definitely worth looking into.
Well, what I thought about is there are already platforms out there that are using this technology, because it's called distributor technology. So we have to do the association. Who's using this technology and what are they doing and how often are they being hacked? You understand? So when we do that association and that breakdown or reverse engineering, then that's better, whether it's in this country, another country, whether we already have, because those systems, they already exist. It's just not existing for wholesale and retail transactions. You got me?
Yeah, it wasn't easy going to Dollar Tree and not being able to use cash.
Yeah, like,
But I mean, I always use my debit card anyways, and a lot of us are already used to doing that. So I could see it changing out. And if it changes 1-to-1, then I don't think there would be so much of a problem as long as we can prove what we have in the bank. Or if they do it right and just go ahead and trade it out 1-to-1, then we won't have a problem for those who have a bank account. For those that don't, I think it could run into an issue because, like you said, if it's tangible, they might not take that tangible dollar traded in. Which may be what happened in India. Isaac, go ahead.
So you said this was happening in other countries already where it's fully implemented. I was trying to go to Japan a while back to see a friend in Okinawa, and one of the things I had to look into was like transportation fares and things like that. So they don't accept like debit cards for trains. They need something called a Suica card, I think. Is that sort of along the same lines? It was like a prepaid type of card, a smart card that looks sort of like a Visa, and you just kind of tap it for any time you need to use train fares.
Well, how did you pay for it? How were you able to acquire the card? Did it have to be a digital transaction to digital transaction, or what were your options to attain the card? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can get it from, I think they can mail it to you, but you can get it from like these just stalls. I don't know what the word is for it. Like you would just go up to a machine that looks like an ATM and you can get it from there. And then you can use an app to control it and like add money to it.
Like a kiosk.
Yeah, a kiosk. Right. Yeah, a kiosk.
Right. So some kiosks, because the kiosks in Wally World or Walmart, you can use cash. That's why I'm asking specific. Because can use cash, then no. If cash is a payment option or coin, then no. I shouldn't say coins because there's actually a crypto coin out there that the U.S. is selling right now. So
right.
I'm going to say tangible dollars. If it didn't accept paper dollars, then yeah, it would probably be more on a CBDC scale. Like we have to understand before this technology becomes official, tests have to be run. They have to see how the people respond, because something like that is going to be dramatic if it's not matched dollar for dollar. It's going to be dramatic. Even if it is matched dollar for dollar, those of us that still, you know, use other type of banking methods, you know, or no bank at all, we're in for a rude awakening, you know. So if that particular kiosk was only digitally operated, meaning you could only use a card, Nicholas, I would say yes, it is a good example of what we'll be headed to or what it would be like. Isaac.
That's okay. But thank you. Yeah, I honestly don't know, just because I've never seen anyone actually use money for it. But it does say like e-money, like smart card, e-money, electronic money.
Right.
But I would have to look more into it to even know. But thank you.
It's definitely something we're all going to have to look into, really, to cover the bases, right? I mean, we don't want to get caught off guard on what's going to happen. So thank you for scaring us all.
my pleasure.
No, this was really excellent. It was and like I said, it's always Masterclass always surprises me because you guys come up with such great topics, you know, and we didn't even know we wanted to know about it, kind of thing. But this was excellent. Thank you so much for the information, and definitely something we're going to look into a little more. I know I am. That's for sure.
Side note, Marjorie. My presentation next week is on the blockchain, which is the technology behind this coin. I think my presentation might help ease those fears a little bit.
Okay, thank you. But it's next week. So correct. I have to go a week of research in the meantime. No, that's going to be great. That'll be wonderful. Thank you. Okay, last but not least, Srikanth, are you ready?
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Only need this a minute to share the screen.
Okay, let me know. You're able to see my screen?
Yes, I can.
Am I audible, clear, and crisp? Okay. All I need is... Okay. Sorry. I know it's late. Good evening, everyone. I'm Srikanth. Today, I'm going to talk about high-performance computing. What I will cover is what is HPC, use cases of HPC, components of HPC, and the future infrastructure along with the references. What is on HPC, generally, it is about, getting a large supercomputer to solve the large problems in science and engineering and business. But what does it translates into regular way is that your laptop have 8-core max or 16-core max cores. And generally servers today, they used to be generally 32 cores to 48 physical cores with dual core CPUs. And the cloud adoption, the new generation, they can go until 128 at this time. But what if the computing, the complex, in order to solve the complex problems, you need a large more amount of cores. So what they have come up is they combine these servers in a specific way to make them as one large supercomputers. And today we're going to talk about those, slightly cover how they are built, what are the primary components, what do we have, the top super computers, and how they are measured, and all these things. And specifically about the measuring, generally computers are measured by the speed, that is the floating point operations per second, which is flops, right? The large supercomputers actually are measured on trillion or which is tera, or the quadrillion, which is peta, and now they are actually working towards making it an exa, the next supercomputers. And the top supercomputers what we have today are most of them are in the US and China. China have close to 167, US have somewhere around 137. And the US made to the top list in 2022. And they released a Frontier. I'm sorry for the background. Okay. They released something which is 1100, close to 1100 petaflops, which is now the largest supercomputer what we have in the world today. Until 2022, Fugaku, Japan is at 442. Lumi is also the latest in 2022, Finland, 309 petaflops, followed by Leonardo, Italy, which is also built in 2022 and tested out and been in service from 22. Last but not the least, on the top five is the Summit US. All these are actually, I think, both Frontier and Summit are from the Oak Ridge laboratories, which they used for the research and all these things. So let's talk about the use cases of the HPC, where and all it's actually used. Before even we talk about the use cases, one thing I wanted to actually highlight is the core elements, right? It's used for the advanced analytics, physics-based simulation, and also for the and the high-performance computing is what it is, the core elements what we have. But the if you see the design cycle of the whole HPC, it would have the preliminary exploration, then the validation, testing, and the final optimization. While these are the common factors about an HPC, it is used in semiconductor space where they do the design verification during the chip designing. So all the chips that are being designed today, supercomputers are used, whether it is in validation, verification, chip layout, classifications, they use in semiconductor space for the EDA and all those things. And then the X science and the energy. This is where the climate, weather, the NASA or the for the weather prediction, and drill and pipeline, seismic, in order to identify how, where and all the materials across the oil on the seabed or anything of that sort, they use these computers. And also in the manufacturing, for the material testing, waste reduction, factory optimization, waste is actually is used or it's used for that. But if you see all these things in general, the primary methods what they do is the structural analysis, multi-body dynamics, then the electromagnetics, hydrodynamics. Each one of the component, whether it's electrical, mechanical, which is the structural, or the fluid, in order for you to simulate these supercomputers to actually write application on top of these and take that model and try to solve that, you know, whether it's a temperature problem or it's whether a radiation problem, they would actually use this. Other major one, that's where the large supercomputers are used in the life sciences. You see the drug discovery, gene research, or the medical devices. This is one of the use space where they had the largest supercomputers. And the most often known spaces are the automotive and the aerospace. Aerospace is where the propulsion, aerodynamics, acoustics for the crash safety in the car. Example, the Tesla itself has 900 miles of simulated road. That much amount of data they have. They have recently released a chip named Dojo, which is much more advanced and used for the supercomputing. So all of these are done in HPC. So there are various vast use cases. AML today, everything the back end of processing that large amount of data, permutation combinations of training data, the computer. Everything is actually is being done on the HPC. So let's see the components of the HPC clusters. At a high level, again, you would have, all of us would have seen the laptops, computers, large servers. And also we have seen cloud and cloud instances. Today we call them instances, whether it's AWS EC2 instances or the Azure instances. But the back end is all servers, right? So what in HPC, what they do is they take these compute nodes and then connect them using an interconnect. There are specific interconnects like the InfiniBand, or there are multiple other companies which provide these specific InfiniBand switches. These are dedicated separate switches. They go at 56. That's like 10 years back, they started at 56. Now they go even to 200 Gbps connection, backbone connections between individual servers. So here, the servers are called compute nodes, computing nodes. So they act in such a way that you can, they are independent of each other, and but they can actually combine together to form a large computer. So all these servers would have the InfiniBand adapters or the interconnects specifically. That way, they can actually connect together as if they are single computer. Right, that's one of the component, and the other component is storage. Generally, you take a laptop or a computer, you install your application, and you keep your data on C drive, B drive. But in HPCs, what you do is you generally have a distributed file system. File systems like from the NetApp or Lustre, there are a couple more, a lot more. In Azure, you have NetApp files. In AWS today, you have Elastic File System, you have Lustre, you have BFS, and all these things. So basically, what these are is that to provide a high-end distributed file system, which is accessible to all these compute nodes at the same time via an NFS, or you know, you can mount it different way, and it's all again backbone, strong backbone. You would not have basically the 10 gig what you see, but what they would do is they would actually combine all these things and form a larger bonds, like 40 gig connections, 100 gig connections kind of thing. It depends on the storage. Or you can have multi-nodes so that a single storage volume can be accessible across all these nodes, right? So the application install would be installed on the storage nodes, making it available on the compute nodes, and the data is also there. Now, there's the other component is the schedulers. Schedulers, what they do is basically, let's take a step back before we go into schedulers. Let's talk about the cluster provisioners. While these hardware is connected, storage is provisioned, the cluster provisioners ensure that all these large amount of computers, like it can be from around 10, 50, 20, 20,000, 50,000 servers. And you cannot go and image them manually. So what they do is that all these, first of all, these nodes are set up in DHCP into a dedicated internal network, and they would be like a plug and play, but connected to a cluster provisioner. So when the node is added, it would actually pull up the image from the cluster provision server and boots up via DHCP. So there is a software like cluster provision like Xcat, Bright Cluster Manager. These are some of the commercial cluster managers. What we have so that this would make an easy update of packages, install of update of images, and all these things on these compute nodes. Now we talked about the storage, compute node, and the cluster provisioner. The next piece is, now all these things are under the control of something called a scheduler. So what does the scheduler take? What it takes is it takes the control of all the computing nodes. It knows where the storage is, where the computing nodes is, how these InfiniBand connections are, which MPI is being used, MPSS message passing interface, to how the communication happens between the compute nodes. Right. And what it does is it will take the control of all these infrastructure and say, okay, hey, application or the user, tell me what to do with the resources. I will manage the resources. You want 100 cores, you want 200 cores for a job, let me know. I'll give it to you. I'll ensure that no other jobs are falling into those nodes. And it is actually restricting and controlling all those jobs. So what does now the user does from a user standpoint of view, what he sees is he sees only a front end. He will see either a web server, or he will see a login server, or he will see a secure server for the data transfer. He will log into the client or some network or a web page, and he will upload the model, which is basically they would like to do pre-processing, post-processing, simulation and post-processing. But they can also just log into the node, give what application. There are multiple applications to simulate each of the component. Like example, if you take in commercial space, that's a wide suite of applications from Ansys. Ansys is one of the biggest simulation vendor. You have Ansys Mechanical for the structural. You have Ansys Fluent for the fluid dynamics. You have Ansys Electrical for the electrical layout, and other products like Synopsys. Synopsys on the major commercial which have a huge suite of applications for the electronic design automation, whether you want to do the layout, physical design, logical design, or testing, everything you have. So you would actually have this application installed. You could keep the model, and you will tell what's your input, what's your output, and you would also say how many nodes and how many or submit a job on 1,000 nodes, 10,000 nodes. But again, your application have to support, understand how it can be distributed across the nodes. So they come and submit the job. And that's where you would see in the universities, there are a lot of slum-based clusters. In the market, you have majorly on the universities, you would see slum-based clusters, which is simple Linux utility for resource management. That's an open where you would see, but there are commercial schedulers also known as IBM LSF, Altair, then the PBS. These are the, and the Torque is the other one, other open source. So there are a lot of schedulers. So users, as long as they know how to use the scheduler, how to submit a job, they would actually log into this and use the syntax, bring in the data from the secure server and apps, right? Before I actually go to the next slide, let me open up for a question and answers. I know I've been giving you, you know, I'm trying to give a lot of things in shorter time, but this is a space which is exponentially growing because today the industry is moving towards spending more time on the virtual development than in the physical development, with the AI coming in, with a lot of things coming in, the dependency on the large supercomputers have increasing a lot.
So does this have, this is very relevant with cloud computing, correct? So this is sort of how companies kind of provide those services to us.
It is actually, I would say it's a yes and no. Why? Because they have large, you have large servers, right? How cloud operates is that you would actually get a large server on top of it. They would put an hypervisor, and they would put an another payload, which would actually provision, deprovision, and all those things, right? But again, it's individual services. Okay, you would get storage as a service. You would get compute as a service. You would get database as a service, or you would get a function as a service. Now, what you have to do is that supercomputers are something like you take all these services, you have to stitch them together to form a cluster. That means you need to have a scheduler, you need to have and storage, you know, to have the computing nodes. So I work for a company where I manage these, and we do a lot in AWS and a lot in Azure. In AWS, what we do is that we have a product named AWS Parallel Cluster, where it connects all these things. It connects Elastic File System from the storage or the CV EC2 instances. The backend is provided by them. There will be specific instances which they will have AWS doesn't follow InfiniBand interconnect, but rather they have something called EFA, Elastic Fabric Adapters, which would actually connect these backbones and give you connections at 100 Gbps connections of the backbones. Yeah, it's a kind of yes and no on what you see. If you are looking at from a scaling perspective, individual scaling, horizontal, whether it's horizontal scaling and vertical scaling, that's about individual nodes and all these things. But these are specifically for the backend with backbone dependency. I hope.
Thank you. It makes sense.
This is a separate space altogether. I know, this is something which is not known much in the commercial spaces because the largest supercomputers is in the research space. Commercial spaces, you would have smaller clusters in flops or teraflops, like 20, 30 teraflops. But whereas research institutions, which does weather modeling, NASA has one of the largest supercomputers what they have. Research laboratories for genome, all those things they have those. On the cloud, that's where I actually wanted to cover what's the future of HPC, right? What they were doing is a large research-based organization continue to build and scale clusters on premises, but now what we are seeing is enterprises are now exploring more and more cloud. Whether you go with Google, Azure, or AWS, what they were going after is after the burstable capacities, burstable capabilities, because there are use cases where they would like to go use it for 10 days, but they wanted to go and use 10,000 cores. That is translate to 200 servers or 500 servers, right? If they buy on-prem and keep it just for that 10 days and 6 months, it doesn't work on the ROI. of that. It doesn't make value. So what they're taking is the inputs and outputs is always smaller for these, because it's more of a permutation combination. It's like, you know, one example of simulation would be, you know, they wanted to know at what temperature this particular part fails. What is the elastic point of this? They would you know, input all the parameters and put like, okay, 101 102 101.2 101.3. so they give this all these wide range, and they say, hey, you know what, can you go ahead and test this and let me know at what a point this particular part fails. If I hit this, like something like crash, if I crash this, if I drop it at from 10,000 feet, or if I hit with this much of pressure, what would I do? So they wanted to see that, but they want to come back and give back to the designer, and designer says, let me redo the part. So that's where they were actually trying to go more and more and do the burst capacity. So companies like the cloud service providers are building large supercomputer clusters and building them. That is one thing. But other thing is capacity, capability, and elasticity. What does this elasticity is that on-prems, you can always have one single data center, or you would have other data center for high availability or disaster recoveries and all these things. But supercomputers, you cannot have scalability, right? So there are SaaS providers, software as a service providers, what like Rescale, Uber Cloud, and you have Ansys Cloud. What these SaaS providers are doing is they are building something called unlimited elastic computing. They're combining all the data centers that are available across the globe, and they're creating a platform. They say, you know what, you submit a job, it's a global scheduler kind of thing. You submit a job, it will tell, okay, if your job needs these many cores, it will go ahead and identify the compute where, in which data center, whether it is in AWS, whether it is in Azure, or whether it's in Google or Oracle, it doesn't matter. You can connect your data center also. It will take the submitted across, go to that particular region, transfer the data, solve it there, bring back the results, and give you. That is something which is changing the way the problems are solved today. It cuts the engineering time. It's like you want to fail fast, because in research you need faster. You want to know how you know, what's the output of this experiment, how fast I can get. If I have to fail fast. This is what is changing the whole landscape of HPC in enterprises. Other thing is that these application licenses are very, very expensive. It is expensive than the infrastructure. What they're doing is that because of this elasticity and this scalability, people, consumers or the users don't have to wait for the compute to be available. They now got unlimited compute because the innovations on the infrastructure and how the cloud innovations and all these things. They can buy less licenses and use it for multiple people because everything is global today. So it's like round the clock, we are seeing the license expenses coming down, right? And also the access to the specialized hardware. In a cluster, generally you will have uniform hardware. In on-prem, that's what people for generations people are doing. That they have either Intel or AMD or large memory, high clock speed, higher L3, L2 cache, and all these things. But the GPUs are expensive. GPUs today, NVIDIA started with P100s, Pascal cards, and they moved to Alpha A100s. And now they are, I think they were introduced last month, H100 cards, right? Which are not expensive, and it takes 6 to 8 months to provision a new hardware in HPC or any place today, because you'll have to order that specialized hardware. You have to get all these components, ship them, bring them up, add to the cluster and all these things. But when you go to the cloud, you have all type of hardware, whether it is NVIDIA, AMD, Intel, compute optimized or memory optimized or HPC specific workloads or the GPU workloads. So this is where the industry is moving towards. And that's where these capabilities, what we are seeing the innovations in terms of self-driving cars, or the research and the medicines. So we look forward. This is a space where which will grow very, very drastically. With that, I end this session. These are the references. Now I'm open for questions.
Yeah, that was a great job. That's pretty interesting. I'm wondering, and I think you answered it, but I'm not sure. So basically, you would have to have a pretty large warehouse or something to have these computers in.
Yes. Yes.
It's not something that, like, you know, I could have in my room. I mean,
no. You cannot have a server in your room. There are people who does a couple of servers in-house, but they emit a lot of, they have high, they are power aggressive. And the moment they are power aggressive, they emit a lot of heat. And they got to be cooled. And if they reach certain temperatures, they go down. It's not like our laptops. So this is specialized. Hardware, specialized zones, large data centers, I think there's a supercomputing conference which happens every year. This is one of the largest supercomputing conference happens in US. There are some conferences in Europe and all these things. I do attend those conferences. Last was, I think it's in Dallas. It happens every year at different location, but that's one interesting conference where you would see a lot of universities, a lot of commercial organizations, cloud service providers, hardware service providers, storage service providers come and present these hardware. You would see liquid cooling. You would see specialized racks. You would see specialized storages. It's not something which regular storage admins or server admins or the you name regular admins would see this. This is specialized hardware.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow. Well, that was really incredible. I'm going to have to bring this up with my students. Yeah, because we talk about servers and stuff and let them know how big these are. It's pretty amazing. Well, that was a great job. I think everybody did a great job tonight. Seriously, there was a lot of information. And I appreciate it because these masterclasses are getting better and better. Anybody else have a question?
Yeah, Srikanth, what's the name of the conference that you're talking about?
Supercomputing. SC23 is now, I think this year, it's called SC23. It goes by the name and the year.
Okay. Thank you, because I wasn't if I'm trying to travel that one and the one Richard mentioned earlier. I'm going to be trying to go to some conferences.
Yeah, at least you know, these are expensive sometimes. At least try to get into their exhibition halls, which would be you know, I think the first one I attended is 2019. And it was like, wow, because I spent a couple of years, almost decade and a half in storage, handling large super 8 petabytes of storage. It's like multiple boxes of storage and multiple servers and all these things. But after spending that much time and handling all these things, and then I moved to HPC and attended this supercomputing conference, I was like, it's like kids looking at going to an amusement park, right? You would see those supercomputers. They actually, I recently, the latest one which I saw, the one of the oldest first supercomputer, they actually displayed it in that conference. It's a Cray supercomputer. And they actually build supercomputers on the floor. They assemble it there, which would act, which would support the whole conference. So that's one space. You know, this is a niche field because you need to know the storage, you need to know the compute, you need to know the hardware, you need to know the schedulers, operating systems, and how you can stitch all this together. On top of this, you need to know the applications. Now, again, there will be specific roles for each one of them. There could be in, people starts with HPC engineers. Their salaries are generally one of the highest average. Earlier, I think Isaac was talking about somewhere around 84 to 90. HPC engineers' average salaries are 112. Average in US and is somewhere around 125 to 130. That's what it goes. And in order to actually move into the space, you need to be either strong in one of these. You need to be strong in Linux, because the most of the supercomputers across the world, 99% of the supercomputers use Linux as the back as their operating system. There are few on Windows now, but you need to have Linux, and you need to have understanding of storage, specifically how these network file systems work, how you would actually distribute file systems, and then the MPIs. There's a specific specialization degree. Heard Santa Cruz University in California provides that HPC specialization, but there are specializations which can teach these. I can send you. I was also researching, you know, how to simplify this. How do I build my team? Because this is something which you won't actually get straightforward in the market. You need to actually find a resource with some kind of background and have an understanding of what this, and start over the years. And once a resource is fully capable of understanding all these things, he's hot kicking the market.
It's like system administration, but like the extreme, advanced. like yes, overclocking.
Advanced. Yes. Thank you. Any other questions? With that, I would end the slide.
All right. Thank you very much. Great stuff, everybody.
Thank you.
I guess that's it for this evening. Did you? I'm sorry, Isaac, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying thanks.
Thank you all.
Thanks. And you all have a great night. Have a great weekend. Keep up the good work, because this is really coming along wonderfully. I should have the video up on PGI Pods probably this weekend. I'll catch up on everything, so you can show everybody what you did and how you did. Other than that, have a great night, everybody. Thank you.
Have a good one.
Good night.